Welcome to A Better Way with Crossroads Bible Church. In our third season, we are answering questions you submitted to us during our What Does the Bible Say About sermon series. Each episode will tackle a wide variety of topics from theology to current events. And now, your host, Charlie Ridenour.
Well, hey, everybody, welcome back to the CBC podcast, A Better Way. It's season three. We're tackling all the questions. And once again, I am joined by Britt.
Hello.
And Dylan.
Hi there.
We have tackled so many questions. We have so many more to go. And this episode is all about origins and eschatology, or
beginnings and ends.
Beginnings and ends. So at the beginning of the last one, we talked about how there's a lot that we could just say, you know, we don't know. We talked about life and pre-life and salvation. And this one, I'd say, is kind of the same. Eschatology especially, but sometimes beginning stuff. We're talking about things that we really don't know, and the Bible doesn't speak a ton to, but there are theories that we've come up with on how to interpret such passages. So I feel like today there is a bunch of different places you can land as a Christian, and I would still say you're just fine in talking about how the world is made and how the world's going to end one day and or keep going. So let's dive in, but man, today is not, if you don't believe this and you're outside of evangelical or outside of the CBC beliefs, if you read our doctrinal statement, it's pretty wide open, because I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't there when God created everything, so I'm not quite sure how many days it took, but that doesn't stop us from pretending like we know. Yeah? So let's go. First question, is the story of creation in Genesis literal, and was the world really created in 7 days? Britt, was it actually literal, and did God take 7 days to create the world?
So this is a really like emotionally charged question. A lot of people have banked a lot on this. And so I think that it's worth kind of looking at the question behind it before we get to, is it literally 7 days? Because for a lot of people, this is a question about whether or not God's word is reliable.
Yeah.
Like, is Genesis true? It's not actually true if it's not literally 7 days. It's kind of an assumption a lot of people bring to this. And I don't think that that is the right way to think about it.
Yeah.
I think what we should start with is Jesus. Like, we have trusted in Jesus for our salvation. We have trusted in him to be our guide and our light. And so as he's the one that's teaching us through the word, we can look at how did he treat the Old Testament. He regarded it as true. It was authentically authored by prophets speaking from God. So we can trust that the Old Testament is true. But things can be true in different ways. And so before we get to Genesis, it's just like there's other stories that we know are true, but they're not literal.
Yeah.
Right? So like David, he sinned with Bathsheba and then killed his friends to cover it up. And Nathan came to him with a story that wasn't literally true, but corresponded by analogy to what happened. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's the rich man, had a bunch of sheep. There was a poor man who had only one sheep, and then he killed that one sheep and took it from him. And that's kind of like David, who has many wives, taking his friend's wife. But there's a lot of things about that story that aren't, you can't take as literal and that don't totally line up, but it's a fiction that Nathan was using in order to expose David's sin and bring him to repentance. So like Jesus does this also with a bunch of his parables. So when we go to the story of Genesis, we're given a story of 7 days of God bringing things into existence. And like the main purpose is God asserting that he's the one true creator. He's the author behind everything. He's the one that set it up. There's not all these other gods, right? So in other belief systems, there'd be the gods who created the plants and the gods who created the animals and the God who rules the sun and the God who rules the moon. And Genesis is saying there's only one God and he created all those things. There's not other gods of those things. It's just him. So that's the main purpose. So when we go to it and we're trying to say, like, was the world originally, like, created in 7 days? That's not what the author's trying to answer. He's trying to answer who is the author of all life and the world. And so we get that answer from that question.
Yeah, I can think of Sunday school teachers that my kids had.
Mm-hmm.
But exactly what you're just saying. Like, if it wasn't literally 7 days, then the rest of the Bible's not reliable. And I know that my kids went to Sunday school and they heard this every week, that it was a literal 7 days. And it was like this emotionally charged thing, because if the very beginning falls apart, well, then we can't hold the rest of it together. And that's just, like you said, not a good way to view the purpose and the, you know, intent of Scripture.
It's a non-nuanced view of one reading and a non-nuanced view of the Bible.
Right.
And so we can absolutely believe that you can be truthful and not literal at the same time. It goes down to you know, really the point behind the point, which is what is the writer of Genesis, whether you believe it's Moses or someone else, whether what is their intent and purpose? Because they're writing in a context to a people. Mm-hmm. And in the A&E, ancient Near East, there's lots of gods, like you said, for all these different things. And no matter what you take out of it, whether you believe in a literal 7 days, which we feel like at Crossroads, you are allowed to do, that's good, great, and grand. Or whether maybe you don't. Maybe you believe in a gap theory or, you know, a long day theory or an old earth theory or a theistic evolution theory. All those things I would say are acceptable to believe in. One of the takeaways is simply that God created and only God created. And that's why it gets into like how he created out of nothing. He needed no help. He had no help. It was just God to fully sustain and create the entire world because out of his glory and pleasure and all those things that we would attribute to God's creative process.
Yeah.
So it's the idea that we talk about what's the reason why he's writing this particular way. I like it too. So, you know, it's the Noahic story of the ark and the flood. There are similar stories that we found in the ancient Near East about man is wicked, flood happens. And so one of the questions people ask is, did the writer of the flood story steal that from another culture and just adopt it to his God? Or is it universally true of the Christian God and then the other writers adapted it to their culture? And one writer makes a comment that I really like. He said, you can read all the other ancient Near East examples of flood. But he said, you know what the difference is between the Christian one? Is that it's the only one where God saves his people and redeems his people and says, this is your path to restoration. And maybe that's what we should be focusing on. And I think the flood is true. We all would. But I think the bigger question there is, what's it saying about the character of God that we see through the creative process, which is vitally important to our question.
Yeah, and to the idea that like maybe this is based on a story that's adopted from another culture, that's actually something we do definitely see elsewhere in the Old Testament,
yeah.
Where, for example, Isaiah will talk about how God is stronger than and will eventually defeat the Leviathan. The Leviathan originally was this sort of semi-divine monster that other gods in the Near East are famous for defeating. And so by stealing that from that story and saying, hey, actually, no, God is like our God is the only one who's strong enough to defeat him. It's kind of like going to a movie. Let's say like the Avengers, you know, the Avengers Endgame story is all about how much struggle was involved and all these different people coming together to defeat Thanos. And it's kind of like saying, you know, God could defeat Thanos in an instant.
Right.
He's so much stronger than all those other, even though those other heroes and Thanos don't exist. It's kind of like using a contemporary story to exalt God.
Yeah.
And so that's what Isaiah is doing with Leviathan. And so if, you know, for example, the flood narrative is taken from another narrative, that would just be showing it's God that is the one who delivers people, not these other gods. And so like, if that's what's happening in Genesis, we're seeing this sequence of God creating the world to assert his dominance. There may or may not be a literalness to that. And there's a lot of Christians who really love Jesus who believe that. But there's also a lot of Christians who really love Jesus who don't. And I think that it's okay to disagree about this. And it's okay to think you're right and think they're wrong and just love them in spite of it.
Yeah, I think this is one of the examples where we probably need to open our palm a little bit because I think if it points to the sufficiency of God to create, it's sufficient for me. But let me ask another question that I think is really important. Let's say somebody did not believe in the literalness of Genesis 1, that maybe God didn't create in 7 days. Why would the writer use that kind of language to talk about creation? Like, why 7 days if it wasn't literal?
I think it has to do with what we find out later in the covenant about Sabbath, and that there's this pattern that God wants imbued in everything of sevens.
Yeah.
There's something about seven that he really likes that's supposed to be part of the natural rhythm of the creation, particularly that we work for 6 days and then we rest on the seventh. And so God is emulating that in the first chapter. So whether or not it is literally 7 days, like that's being accounted for, he is creating for six in the story, and then he rests on the seventh as a pattern for the rest of us.
I agree. I'd also add that I think there's an order in the 7 days that builds off one another. And again, we talked about it in a sermon a couple weeks ago on Sunday, but God is a God of order. And when we live into that order, we all flourish. And so I think it shows an ordered God, a measured God, a thoughtful God, a rhythmic God. And that's how we're supposed to live. But also, you know, some people believe that we believe that God created the world in seven little days. And that's great, too. But I think it's okay to say, hey, the purpose of that text is to show that God created all things. And that's where we have to start. I'd say if you get outside of those bounds, then you're outside of what we would say is okay in orthodoxy. If you start to believe that God for some needed help or didn't create out of nothing or wasn't the cause or the genesis of all things, then we're outside the bounds of what we would say is acceptable or okay to believe in terms of, you know, like our channel of faith. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or like that God was created or.
Yeah. No, that can be true. Yeah. And this goes against all of that. Yeah.
Another thing that comes up that I think is really interesting, because God's setting up a bunch of things at the same time, is that he has these different realms that are created in the first 3 days, right? We've got the realm of the sky and the sea and the land, and then he fills those over the next 3 days, where we've got birds and fish and animals and people. Mm-hmm. And that I feel like the story of Scripture is about how God is creating a place to then meet with people. And so he's starting from the get-go of like, here's all these places in which he can be glorified. And then he fills them up because he loves the life that he's created.
Mm-hmm. With the things that will glorify. Yeah, absolutely. That's good. Here's our next question. It kind of goes off this just a little bit, but how do we balance science and faith? So it's going to go down to, well, if you believe that it's actual literal 7 days, and then you look at science, sometimes it might not necessarily agree with the Christian accounting of New Earth and seven literal days and all the things you can fill in the blanks with. So how do we balance science and faith, especially in conversations about the beginnings of the world? One of the things that I like is I think that we want to end that conversation before it's ended. So right now we want science and faith to be fully reconciled, and they're not, because we don't know everything yet. And science is an exploration into what we know to be true, provably true about our world. And one of the things that I love is that the more we find out about the world we live in, the more actually I see harmony with how the scriptures talk about how God created. So, you know, we just launched this new telescope, which is doing phenomenal things, the James Webb Telescope. And I follow it and I watch the pictures. And the more we can see literally into space, which you could argue is seeing into the past based on how light like moves, we've seen for a long time, I think Einstein even talked about it, that there is an actual starting point, they believe, to all of this. Like, there's a genesis to all of created order and matter, and it's still expanding, which is fascinating to me, which means that, like, there's a starting point and place to our universe. And to me, when it comes down to, like, one of the reasons I firmly believe in God is because it goes down to that argument about, well, there had to be a beginning to the beginning, and that's who God says he is. And so when we talk about science and faith, I actually see more now that's in line with who God is, and then the science that we find, the further we explore the depths of our universe, that I think I ever had before, which is kind of fascinating to me. Mm. You know, you can even go down to like the Fermi paradox and the idea of that, is there life outside of this earth? And did God just create this whole universe and waste it just for us? And, you know, back in the 50s, when this question got postulated, they thought there's like a 90% chance that there was extraterrestrial life. And then they started adding to this list all these things necessary for life. And it started with 4. And now it's up to, I think, several hundred. And now they say that there's a research paper done at Oxford years ago that talks about how now scientists are moving towards this belief that it's actually more unlikely that there is life outside Earth than more unlikely that there isn't for the first time ever because of how unique this space is. Again, proving to be true that there's design behind what God created. And science is then, once again, pointing to the goodness of the creation of we see of God. Not happenstance, but intentionally designed by a being that is incredible and we would call it God.
Yeah. And I mean, one thing that I think is interesting to know about history with the concept of science is that it was essentially people got it going were Christians. Because
yeah,
before
true.
That, the
huge.
Philosophical, like dominant views were like Platonism or Aristotelianism, and both of them are consumed with the idea that you would think through things, and that's how you derive truth. So like you look at stuff a little bit, but you mostly have to come up with ideas of what makes sense. And it wasn't until Christians were like, hey, because we value the creation, because God created this stuff, and he actually said in the word, go look at the world to learn more about me.
That's right.
Like, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God, and, you know, Solomon's always talking about go and find this animal, go look at the ant or the lizard and learn wisdom from them. Christians said the world and the senses God gave us to perceive the world are something that we can derive truth from. So they started doing experiments, they started studying the natural world, and that's how we got the scientific revolutions that we've experienced
yeah.
is because Christians thought, I can test this stuff and I can trust my senses and it's not all just in the realm of reason. So like the beginning of science was all people who believed. There was no conflict between faith and science. It's only because of recent generations where a lot of people in the West have kind of become post-Christian and decided, oh, we don't need God for this stuff, that we've started to see something like a conflict. But that is not in history.
Yeah, it's a sacred secular split, right? It happened in the 18th century, and so he comes out, and now for some reason religion is relegated to the second tier of society as we try to become a society that can prove goodness and become better people because we are more knowledgeable, and that's been proven to be untrue over the last 100 or so years. And so really, I think we're coming back to a place where science and faith, or science and religion, are actually more involved in the same circles in terms of how we talk about it than in the last 100 years, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. Which again, I love this kind of conversation because it's going to take a lot to shake my view in the goodness of God and God's created order. What I mean by that is there's more evidence too that I feel like than science can disprove with one fact. So you could bring a dinosaur leg to me and say, I found it next to a human leg and it existed 600,000 years ago. And I'll say, okay, then I might not understand X, Y, and Z, but it doesn't shake my belief in God and in redemption and in creation, because it's the best answer I've found for the world that we live in. How to see it, how to find hope in it, how it was created, and all those things. So part of it's just saying, I might not know yet, but one day I will, you know, as I balance those things together.
All truth is God's truth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and I think it's really, like, I think our quest, our need for answers is grounded in this idea that I need to feel safe. I need to feel in charge. I need to feel like I know something. And really and truly, that is not a good place to approach God from, because really I need to come to God with a very humble attitude of, Lord, what is it that you want me to know, rather than how I can figure out God.
Yeah,
like if I want to come to experience him, I'm going to do that through humility, not through I can prove you or disprove you.
Yeah.
And then another thing I was thinking, Brett, I want to come back to what you said about how God asks us to experience him through things around us.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably been has it been 2 years ago now that we first started having lunch together, and you used to pray before we would have our meal that you were so thankful that God made food taste good.
Mm.
And like, I literally, I still think about that. I thought about it at lunch today.
Mm.
I thought about the food that I was eating, and I was just eating it. And I was telling the Lord, like, how grateful I am that he created this earth for me to enjoy. Like, there was no need to make food taste good.
Yeah.
Right? There was no need for that. That is just an example of his absolute mercy and goodness and his joy, his abundant joy. And he wants me to experience that.
Yeah.
And he's created a world that is beyond my understanding and is beyond my comprehension. But yet in my little world, I have all that I need to know him and to experience him and to realize that he's good. Mm. I don't have to have all the answers to everything, but he's given me all that I need to know that he's good.
You know, I like what you said a lot, just because it makes me think about, I don't think the purpose is for us to ever reconcile the inexhaustible nature of God's majesty. So the fact that science and religion or faith aren't reconciled fully right now might be an ongoing reality, because we can never get to the end of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes us dependent in a way that wouldn't be otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love, man, we should explore, then we should learn, and we should press in, and we should make scientific advancements wherever we could. But I don't think us not knowing is a threat to God.
Right.
Which I think is really valuable. And maybe he designed it that way so that we'd be dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Because it goes back to the Tower of Babel. Like, what does man want to do? Build something where they can show God they don't need him anymore. Like, we can do it all ourselves. It's like, no, you can't. Because to get back to the first question, I created and I alone created. And I alone set the earth on its axis, we told Job and all the things. But one plug I'd give for a website that's been helpful for me is BioLogos. Really cool website. Their whole mission is to integrate the conversations of science and faith all over again. And really smart people with lots of letters in front of their name. And that's how you know it. And they talk about how our relationship, a deep, deep affinity for science, deepens our affection for Jesus and for God. So I encourage you to go there and check it out, read all the things, and sound smart to your friends and family, which is really why we do this podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Love it. The next question we got, let's go into some creation stuff. Is the old earth view of the world compatible with the Bible? And then there's a parenthetical, could Adam and Eve have been born 100,000 years ago?
So to the first part of the question, is it compatible? Yes.
Yeah.
Like you were saying earlier, Charlie, that there's these different views of how to take the 7 days. There's something called the gap theory. There's something called a long earth, an old earth theory. That's what this is talking about. There's a idea of like the days being ages. So the day age theory, and then like theistic evolution being a part of that. And so the idea that, you know,
theistic evolution being that God created it, then said, grow and go.
Right. And that he set up DNA and the mechanisms of adaptation and all that in the animal world to bring about life.
Right.
So, like, all of these things are compatible in that the Bible itself is not trying to answer the question of how long ago did the world come into existence. It's trying to answer who brought the world into existence.
Yeah.
And so there are dates and there are ages and things in Genesis, but there are reasons to think that there could be gaps in there. And there's also this whole idea that some of this is meant to be expressing a truth that isn't necessarily literal, even if it is a concept. And so people disagree about this.
Yeah. No, I personally probably take an older view of the earth and a younger view of humanity. And so like Adam and Eve, I probably take a younger view on. There's lineages that you can trace back and forth. But I think years ago, they asked me like, hey man, have you ever talking about, you know, carbon dating, and they dated hundreds of millions of years ago, and how is it a problem for people that take a more conservative view of Genesis 1? And they looked at me and said, I mean, no, because have you ever seen a young mountain? What does that look like? So what if God created the world? What if he like created it old? Like Adam and Eve were made fully formed.
Right,
like,
they were adults.
They were adults when they were created, and it seemingly escapes us when we try to explain, well, how can the earth be 6 million years old? Maybe at the beginning God said it's going to start at 4 million. I don't know. I'm just, again, we're trying to reconcile. It's like, God's still good in this. And so Adam and Eve were created fully formed. And what that means for the rest of creation and the age of the earth, especially with how it's stated scientifically.
Plus, kind of going back to that first question of this idea that faith is this ongoing, never really ending exploration of who God is. So is science, looking at the world. And so we've come to places where we realize the models that we're using, the methods that we're using have a flaw in them. And so while the current dating of things is something that is rigorously tested and people are working on, there could be a mistake. There could be something in there. So science is never really either kind of the end tail on something. Like, this isn't the definitive answer. This is the theory that we're working with right now that makes the most sense of the data that we're getting. But we could find out that all of that carbon dating, we had one little thing wrong, and it's all off by a factor of 10 or whatever. Like, it's just, science is an ongoing discussion as well. And so, I don't think it matters too much, Adam and Eve totally could have been here 100,000 years ago.
And this is the whole Genesis 1 account. At the end of the day, the constant is God.
Yeah.
The constant is God, and other things move. So that's kind of my view on Genesis 1 and creation is our constant is God. He's the constant creator, and there's a means by which he could have done it. That honestly, we can just only say we don't know. You could strongly hold your point of view, but none of us actually know because none of us are actually there. And the Bible just describes how good God is when he created. So, another one on that, somebody asked, what does the Bible say about evolution? Man, I remember that word was almost a curse word in the Christian narrative. When you said evolution, it was real bad. So what does the Bible say anything on evolution at all? Does it address it?
I mean, it doesn't.
Yeah.
But I have heard something that I actually kind of like. If you look at Genesis 1, and it talks about God creating the animals and the birds and the fish. You have this statement where God said, let the water swarm with the living creatures. And then later it says, let the earth produce living creatures. And so I've heard some people make the argument that this is God commanding the earth to then bring about life, to then have that process start proceeding from it. Because he's not just snapping his fingers and animals exist. He says, let the earth produce. And so that could be a poetic way of God referring to this. At the same time, we know that God, you know, in the story, it's talking about God had formed the man out of the dirt and then breathed the breath in his mouth. So a lot of this is figurative language for God's creative acts. And so, like, that's not a definitive thing, but that is something I've seen people point to of, like, the earth is producing this. That's something that God created and ordained and set in motion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting, like I said, these things are interesting ways that we can say, well, maybe, and look. And that's kind of why I like these kind of conversations, is it's kind of wide open to theorize a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think, what does the Bible say about evolution? Not a ton. It wasn't really addressed because it wasn't at that point, a plausible idea of how creation started, because everything is so rooted in some kind of godness in some respect, the immaterial or the majestic or the mystic. And so, I mean, the Bible says that God's the author of all things. I'm okay if people are theistic evolutionists. I know some Christians would disagree there. As long as you believe God started it all, I think that's all that's really necessary to be inside of orthodoxy. But I hold specific opinions on it, but I think that's a good starting point. So,
sort of a random thing here at the end that I just think is worth mentioning about the Genesis story in comparison with other cultures. So, like, the Babylonian narrative started with the idea that the gods were fighting and they killed an evil dragon.
Yeah.
And out of the dragon's blood and body and bones created the physical world. And then there's, you know, like the Egyptian story or the Greek story, where you have one god who just sort of another god popped out of, and then suddenly they started having kids and they started having kids and they started having kids. And that led to the physical world and to all these things. So it's like through this endless genealogy of many gods or through violence and like whatever. And then our God, how does it present that he spoke and the things came into existence. That he's not doing violence, he's not depending on anybody else and lineages and things. He just is powerful enough to speak the world into existence. So whatever actually happened once he commanded it to happen, there's just this statement about how God is so different than these others.
Yeah, I think that's what the Genesis 1 story is doing, is showing how different the Christian God is. At that point, the Hebrew God was from all the other gods around them. Yeah. And all the cities and the countries and the people groups they went into.
Okay, can I introduce the next question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. So I want everybody to know that what we're actually looking at is like a spreadsheet where we have the list of the questions, and then we've like listed down what we, you know, might want to say mm-hmm. about the question. And so the next question literally says dinosaurs.
That's what somebody sent in.
Period.
Yeah. There was not even a question mark.
No question mark. Just the word dinosaurs. And then Britt's answer is are awesome. Mm-hmm. I left it blank. And Charlie said, lived in Glen Rose, Texas.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You got to see the dinosaur prints. They're real. And they're there. I'm going to take Eleanor sometime.
So clearly, we all have really good thoughts about dinosaurs.
Yeah, fully formed. Fully formed thoughts on dinosaurs. What does the Bible say about dinosaurs? They're awesome. And they lived in Glen Rose, everybody. Uh-huh. That's as far as I got. Now, you can go to Glen Rose and actually have, I think they have a biblical museum there that talks about the dinosaurs. I don't know what to say about it. I mean, I think they're awesome. I remember that Jurassic Park was a formative movie for me because that's one of the first times I saw a movie that was so realistic and just blew my mind. But I think it's been a while since I've studied this, but what I remember being taught was that dinosaurs existed and roamed the earth with the first people, and after the flood, they couldn't exist anymore. Thought being, there's a protective bubble around the world, there's a constant mist in the world, oxygen levels higher. When that got burst, which is where the water came from, out of the heavens and out of the skies, out of the earth below, then they just couldn't make it anymore. They couldn't get enough oxygen to live any longer. So, and have you guys heard stuff like that?
Yeah, there's all kinds of theories. Because, right. Again, everything that we're talking about of, like, was the world created in literally 7 days or in, these day ages referring to long periods of time? How does evolution factor into that? Also factors into the discussion of where do you put dinosaurs in the concept. So did they die in the flood? Did they die long before that because they'd gone extinct? Like, there's, Christians are going to fall in a lot of different places based on the science, based on some of these other beliefs about the 7 days.
Yeah. So I think as long as you believe the dinosaurs are awesome and you know they lived in Glen Rose, you're okay theologically.
Yeah.
Right? That's right. Let's move on. So out of the beginnings, we move all the way to the endings. We're talking about eschatological questions. The study of the end times or what will be. First question we got is, where do we go after death? Sleep versus heaven.
So there's several places we could go with this. But one of them that's really famous is the 2 Corinthians chapter 5, where Paul is talking about how he needs to be here, like teaching people. But he would sure love to go be with Jesus, which would mean that he physically die. But what we... is clear in that passage and several others is that when someone dies and they believe in him, their consciousness, whatever that means, their soul or spirit or whatever we want to call it, is going to go spend time with Jesus now. They're going to go be in the presence of Jesus. There's this question about sleep, and there are some minority Christian groups that will actually talk about how that consciousness doesn't go be with Jesus. They actually go to sleep. And I think that comes from Jesus' words in John and a couple other places where people who die are referred to as being asleep.
Sorry. It said Lazarus in a couple other places. Yeah.
So Jesus even says Lazarus is asleep.
Yeah.
And the disciples are like, oh, let's go wake him up. And
Jesus he's like, no, like, no.
No, he's dead. He's dead. I'm being poetic about it.
Yeah.
And he goes and he wakes him up. He raises him up. And there's several other places where Christians are referred to as dying, but the euphemism is that they fell asleep. But I think the confusion comes from the fact that that is referring to the body sleeping. It's a metaphor for their body is now dead, but one day will be raised when Jesus returns. And so you can call it sleeping instead of dead because he's going to wake them. But we know from elsewhere that when death happens, they are consciously with Jesus after they die.
Yes, I saw the Old Testament a couple times. I don't have the chapter and verse in front of me, but when people died, they said they fell asleep. They found sleep. They found rest in that respect. But I think the easiest answer is they go to be with Jesus. The thief on the cross, today you'll be with me in paradise kind of sort of mentality. Yeah. So where do people go after death? You got to be with Jesus. And then I think the next question flows out of that. What does the Bible say about heaven? Britt, your dad, who is an elder at CBC, I did a sermon on heaven. How long ago was it?
I don't remember. A couple years.
It was a long time ago. I think it's before I took over the senior pastor role, I want to say. It might have been. So it might have been 4 years ago. Maybe it was sooner than that. I don't remember. But I think he heard something that either I said wrongly or didn't mean to say or just disagreed right out. But every time heaven comes up now, he's like, don't ask Charlie about his view of heaven. Think your dad thinks I don't believe there is one. I very much do. This is to you, Bruce. I very much do believe there's a heaven. I believe heaven is good. My definition of heaven, and has been for a long time, is heaven is the place where God's presence is fully felt. He's fully known, and everything is fully blessed. So it's just the idea where God is fully God, and then we reap the rewards of God being fully God all the time. So outside of that, we'll get into it. What does the Bible say about heaven?
So heaven is used in a lot of different ways.
Yes.
But there's kind of two main categories, and I don't know if the person asking this question is referring to one or the other. But one is, where do people go right now when they die? Right? Where if it says that we go to heaven when we die, and we're with Jesus, where is that? That place that we could call heaven? Other people are talking about, where do we end up? Right? When Jesus brings everybody together, where are we all together?
Yep.
And those are actually different places.
Yep.
The first one is often shown in visions in the Bible, where Isaiah goes up there or John goes up there and sees God in the middle of a big old temple. He's on a huge throne. People are around him. People are together. They're worshiping him. It's amazing and it's wonderful and hard
holy,
to
holy, holy, holy. I mean, all the things. Yeah.
All the
lots
angels,
of white robes. Lots of all the things.
Lots of angels that look very strange.
Yep.
But then there's also what is pointed to in Revelation and in Isaiah of this place where Jesus is ruling. He is in like relationship with all of us, but he has raised us from the dead and he has brought together what we would call heaven and earth into this new heavens and new earth, and that there's no longer any separation from the presence of God. Everything is full of the presence of God, and everything is like perfect and wonderful. That end result after Jesus returns is different than where someone would go right now.
Yeah, new heavens, new earth, on into perpetuity, into eternity. Yep.
And so, like, the people that are in heaven right now, there's even a passage in Revelation that talks about how they're longing, and they're even asking God, like, hey, when is it? They're excited about it. When's the time that we get to go back into our bodies? We get to return with Jesus. We get to be in this new place.
Yeah.
And
I've got a buddy right now, awesome. One of my best friends who, so I moved to this community in East Dallas. This is probably 4 or 5 years ago now. We bought our first house, and we have some friends there, and he's one of my best friends, and he lived there, like down the street, and then we moved in, and he moved out right away, which I've not forgiven him for. he had to move for some reasons, and some stuff came up, but he moved into an apartment about 2 miles away, and he's got 2 young kids, and they've been in an apartment for 4 years now. And they're together, and it's good, and they're a family, and they're a healthy family, but they actually move into their house that they've been building in another part of East Dallas next week. And it's just like that, and it's been pushed back a couple times, but like his kids, every day I'll be like, is now the day that we get to move into this new place? Like, is now the day that it's going to happen? He's like, no, it's coming. I promise it's soon. It's kind of analogous to that. And I use that example because at the same time that their lives are going to change dramatically because they're going to move into this house, it's also going to look a lot like it looked before because they're still going to be in East Dallas. And this is something I think we get incredibly wrong as the church, is that we feel like heaven is this other place where we float on clouds and kind of like a Greek god Mount Olympus picture instead of a created picture that Genesis 1 lays out. And so I think it's, you know, Platonism gone amok, but I think it's this idea that I was told as a kid that what's heaven going to be like? It's going to be perfect and it's going to be beautiful and there's going to be streets of gold and you're going to get to worship Jesus all day, every day. And I thought to myself, if there's not basketball at 8 years old, I'm out. How can that be good? How can that be heaven? And I think when we talk about what heaven is, it's a place where God fully resides and exists. He is making a new heaven, new earth. But I think that place is going to look a lot like the good thing that God created in the first place. I think there's going to be mountains and trees, and we're going to be able to ride bikes, and I don't know if cars are going to be there. They're not redemptive in any capacity, but I think...
No way, man.
That's right. But I think it's going to look... I'm curious to know you guys' thoughts on this. I think it's going to look a lot like what God created in the first place, because he said it was good. You know, it's that weird thing. It's going to look a lot like it, but completely different. Like my friends in the apartment in the house, because there's not going to be the stain of sin or sadness or the residue of evil or the weight of injustice on us. It's going to be incredibly beautiful. But
yeah. I just want to throw that out. It's so hard for us to imagine that, like the thought of living without worry, without strife, without envy or jealousy or greed or, you know, like how is it that I could actually exist like that? That's really hard to imagine. It's really funny that years ago, back at another church that I worked at, we used to do this thing for every Halloween. They did this thing called the House of Judgment.
Mm.
And it was terrible. The point of it was to literally scare the hell out of teenage kids. And they would bring them in buses
So I hundreds remember, of I remember, kids. I think when you came on staff, you told me about this. I didn't know it existed.
Yeah.
And I was mortified.
Yeah, so my office was in hell, literally. And so I would have to walk down the hall, and it was been blacked out with curtains, and there were black lights in the ceiling, and there were demons, on, you know, pictures mm-hmm. of demons hanging on the wall. And so I would have to thump my hand down the wall to find my door and get between the curtain and the and to get in. And so the storyline was, you know, like this, you know, two kids, you know, one die, one goes to hell, and literally you go through hell, and it is like graphic, and it's hot, and there's screaming and all this stuff. And then the other kid goes to heaven, and you literally walk through this and think, man, if this is what heaven's going to be like, the other one at least was had something going on.
Because it was just so,
you know, like we can't even imagine, like we have a hard time depicting to each other mm-hmm. the beauty and the majesty of God in heaven.
Yeah.
And I just think that, like, Britt, you were talking about a new heaven and a new earth. I don't know if you had Dr. Bingham or if he was still at DTS when you were there, but, you know, he used to always say that Texas is going to look like Texas, like in the new heaven and the new earth, when God comes to live here in some kind of redeemed earth, that he still believed that, you know, there's still going to be continents, and there's still going to be, you know, of course, the deserts will be turned into gardens, and God will have renewed all things. But that, you know,
if the climate's the same amount, guys.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I'm hoping, you know, like I need garden, the climate will, you know, likely be different.
In July in Texas, it is, heaven's not on my mind. I mean, it is not even close. Yeah. Not to blaspheme Texas. I was born and raised in this place. Love it. But
I think it's so important for us to have like an actual real vision of heaven in our mind. Because if it's like this other church that I used to go to, if our idea of heaven is so far from reality, it doesn't create this longing. Like you're talking about these kids, like, it's important in my transformation now for me to be able to dream and think about what would it look like for me to actually live free of worry, free of guilt, free of shame. Like, that's what heaven is.
Yeah.
You know, it is an actual place, but it is a beautiful connection where I have no reason to want to hide from God. Mm. And so when I think of what is heaven going to be like, yeah, I think a physical place is really important, but I also think like the relationship is so important, like with people and with God.
Yeah, I do. I think it's important to kind of bring those two together and realize that it's a physical place that maybe isn't described in terms of opulence, and I'm sure there'll be some of that, but also a place that's free of the things that make this world hard. And that, I mean, it's impossible to think through that because like even my thoughts are fallen. And so it's hard for me to even think about being selfless. Well, if I can think about it and it's anywhere near good now, imagine, you know, what it will be like. And imagine. So it's a good thing. And I think there's basketball. And how clearly much, Texas makes it.
How much I would love to serve other people.
Yeah.
You know, like, let that inform how I want to serve people now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the next question. So this one, Britt, you said you'd gotten this question before. I don't know if I had gotten this question before. It's interesting to me. So I'll let you kind of take first crack at it. Once we go to heaven, we have forgotten, that's in quotes, we've forgotten who the ones we loved are and can't recognize them. So let me rephrase it. When we get to heaven, will we have forgotten who the ones we loved are, and will we be able to recognize them?
I think that we will. I think that we will know each other. Like you, Charlie, a lot of people, it wouldn't even occur to them to think that we'd forget each other.
Yeah.
But I think this comes from a couple different passages, the main one being Luke 24. When Jesus rises from the dead, he's walking down a road with the two disciples that are going to Emmaus, and it says that they're kept from recognizing him. And so people will look at that story and see like, oh, Jesus has risen from the dead, and he's not able to be recognized. That means that when we're in our resurrected bodies, we won't look the same, and we won't be recognizable. And there's a fear associated with that. But that forgets all the other times when he appears to the disciples and they do immediately recognize him.
Yeah.
And also that it specifically says that they were kept from. This is a one-time thing where for Jesus' own purposes, he's disguising his appearance. He's making it to where they cannot recognize him. But then he does reveal himself when he's at, when he does communion with them, actually. So like that's a one-off. But for the most part, when people see Jesus, they recognize who he is. And I think that we're going to be able to recognize each other in the resurrection. And I think that there's just this fear that's there But like, I don't think that it's a grounded fear.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you're talking other times, it could also come from in John, I think it's John's gospel, when Mary sees Jesus at the tomb, mm-hmm. when she calls him the gardener. And like, hey, but I think she didn't recognize because she's probably like ugly crying and probably not looking at him and doesn't care. And so I don't think that's I don't recognize his physical body or form. And then she does right away when he speaks to her. But I think that's an interesting point too, is yeah, that's a one-time thing. And every other time disciples saw him, they're like, that's Jesus. And so that's important.
I mean, there's even, I've heard one person talk about this. A lot of times people that are manual laborers, like gardeners, would not be wearing very many clothes. And yeah. Jesus, having risen from the dead, having removed a lot of his grave clothes, he might have only been wearing like a loincloth or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if she sees a man who is only in a loincloth, she would immediately look away because she's a Jewish woman who knows yeah. to be modest. And so she would see a figure, but not necessarily have even looked at his face before looking away. But that's a just as easily readable way to read that in that passage, that she like noticed there was a figure and is like, oh, where's the body? But she recognizes his voice.
And more than that, we'll end with this. I think that we'll recognize people because God is a God of relationship.
Yeah.
It's nature to the Trinity. And I think that some of the ways in which I glorify God the most is I had lunch today with someone I've known for all my 14 years here. And they're in a family transition and it's been really hard, but it's going to be really good for them. And they've known me through all my transitions. And she joked when I first saw her, like, how's life? And me moving, you know, from Dallas to the suburbs, from single to a wife, from no kids, two kids. And just like everybody else does, joked that she saw it coming 14 years ago, even though I said it's never going to happen. And the some of the greatest joys that I have, some of the greatest ways I see the goodness of God is the people he allowed me to be in a relationship with at this place. And I don't think that's going to go anywhere in heaven. I think it'll deepen. I think those relationships will deepen. I think we'll be able to say, look what God gave us. And that's a good thing. So, yeah, I think we'll be able to recognize one another simply because that's how we're created. That's what we're created for, and that's how we glorify God.
Yeah, I'm sitting here wrestling whether or not I wanted to say what I was thinking. I don't know who asked this question, and I just want to be tender to like what they're asking. Mm-hmm. Because like if they have lost someone and they're wondering if they're forgotten, like mm-hmm. their loved one will not remember who they are when they're reunited, like that could be a deeply painful place for them to you know, a fearful place. And so I'm just going to throw this out. You're going to have to take it with a grain of salt. And this is, you know, extra biblical. There is a book called 90 Minutes in Heaven. So if this is a, like a really tender place for you, I would recommend reading that book. Just the premise is this guy's in a car crash and he's pronounced dead on the scene and he's, you know, he claims in the thing that he went to heaven. He was outside the gates, but there was a crowd of people, all that he knew. And he describes them in great detail. And he talks about his grandmother and that he clearly knows her, but he talks about her skin. He talks about her eyes and her teeth. Like he immediately knew it was her. And he was like so happy to see her and to be reunited with her. But there was a difference in their appearance.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you just have to take that for what it's worth. I understand we're asking, what does the Bible say about? And I'm answering something that's not what the Bible yeah. says. But, you know, if you're coming to this question from a place of pain, consider reading it. It's
yeah, it's good.
It's good.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Next question we got on this, a few more left. What does the Bible say about the end of the world?
So my first thought about this question is that we use that phrase a lot. We talk about the end of the world, you know, how things going to end. But the actual biblical phrase is usually the end of the age. The idea being that there's going to be a new age that follows it. The age of Jesus ruling and reigning, surrounded by all that he's you know, brought to himself after he comes back and he set up his kingdom and he's ruling and to the fullest extent. So we're not really necessarily talking about the world coming to an end as much as we're talking about this age of sin and death being ended and Jesus starting a new one.
Amen. Let it be.
Yeah, I was reading through, you know, Matthew 24, and it says, they asked the disciples, that Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives. The disciples said to him privately, tell us, he said, when will this happen and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Same thing. And Jesus said, watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. So what I love about that is, for all of my life, I've been told that we are minutes away from God coming back because people are pissed at each other. and because there was 3 earthquakes last month, and because I don't know if I think that's the best gauge to look at it. Jesus says people are going to use that, and they're going to be deceivers. And he says, in the middle of those things, don't be alarmed. That's going to happen. But watch out for like the real signs. And there's something you get in Thessalonians, Man of Lawlessness,
yeah,
right? That talk about those are actual signs. You know, we're going to get there in a sec. But like the great, the tribulation is going to happen. But then like the great falling away. Like those are actual signs. But what's going to happen to the world at the end of it? I think it's going to get dark. And depending on what you believe about how God ends things, he's going to pull believers out at a certain point. But it's going to get bad, real bad, real bad. And then Jesus is going to redeem, which is what Jesus does. Going on that a little bit. Yeah. What are the signs then of the end times and the rapture?
Yeah. So 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul goes into this because there's actually been some people trying to convince the church in Thessalonica that the end has actually come and that these things have started. And he's like, no, not yet. And he says, like, this isn't going to start happening until you see the man of lawlessness. Mm-hmm. So the way Paul describes him, Jesus also talks about him a little bit in Matthew 24. Jesus actually pointed back to Daniel. Daniel talks a little bit about him. But basically, right near the end, there's going to be this guy who's going to start having worldwide influence. Satan's actually going to be given permission to throw all his resources behind this guy. So Satan's been behind all kinds of evil, you know, lifting up rulers, trying to do, you know, destruction to God's people and the world because he hates us. But it seems like there's this one guy that Jesus is going to be able to, or Satan's going to be able to throw all his resources behind, and he's going to be kind of like the last hurrah of Satan's kingdom. And like that guy, he's going to noteworthily be someone who starts claiming that he's God, and a bunch of people start believing it. Because it says God actually is going to say everybody who's rejected Jesus is going to fall for the delusion that this guy is God. And so until we have that, where like the whole world is either worshiping Jesus or this one political leader, we're probably not there yet. That's what Paul seems to be.
With how divided we are, yeah. We're not there for a long time.
But then actually, like the end happens when Jesus comes back and he orders this guy's execution, that this guy dies at Jesus' return. And it's sort of Jesus is finally defeating everything that belongs to Satan. So like until we have one world leader, everybody's worshiping except Jesus, we're not there yet. So there's been world empires and big wars and rumors of wars and things. That passage that Jesus talks about, he actually says in the middle of there's going to be wars, rumors of wars, natural disasters, famines, but these are not the sign of the end.
Yeah.
A lot of people have taken them as if they are the sign of the end.
No, they're not.
And for generations of the church, like every generation pretty much has been like, I think it's going to be us.
From,
it's been 1900
from the
years.
First church on, yeah. They said, yeah. And there's been people that have like actually dated it too.
Yeah.
And they're wrong every single time. And I'd say on that, I think that's great. I think that's absolutely the signs of the end times is a union around people that aren't Jesus. And you're going to see a stark division between Jesus and everything else. And then also, you know, what are the sign of the rapture? There really isn't one. The rapture is going to happen. And again, depending on when you believe it, mm-hmm. and whatever Kirk Cameron movie you watched, people are just going to disappear.
So, for people that don't know what the word rapture means, it comes from the Latin word that is the translation of the Greek word. Mm-hmm. It comes from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, where it says that the dead in Christ are going to rise. Jesus is going to return. He's going to raise the Christian dead. And then the other people who are still alive are going to be caught up, mm-hmm. Harpazo, where we get the word rapture from. They're going to be snatched up and brought into Jesus' presence. And so there's debate about when does that happen relative to the rise of the man of lawlessness and the kingdom and the millennium and all of that. There's different positions, but that's what this is referring to, this time when all the Christian dead are raised, all the Christians who are alive are united with them, and they're snatched into Jesus' presence. So when does that happen? Well, there's not really any specific sign of when it's going to happen other than Jesus returning. So when he's in the sky, then that's the sign.
We'll just keep going on this. One of the questions somebody asked was, what is meant by the phrase falling away when talking about the end times? And I think that comes from 2 Thessalonians 2. And I'll read it. Let me look it up quick. It says, let no one deceive you in any way, for that day will not come unless the rebellion comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. And when it talks about that rebellion there, it literally it's, you know, the word for apostasy that we get in the Greek or falling away from the ways of Jesus, what Hebrews deals with when it's talking about it, what Romans, the end of Romans deals with. Like, don't let these people fall away from the faith they have in God. So someone wants to know what is meant by the phrase falling away when talking about the end times.
Britt, how many times have you talked about Revelation?
How many times have you talked about, like, since you've been on staff at CDC, which was 2 years?
I've been on staff for 2 years.
And you've done
that time. Yeah. I think I've done it with 7 or 8 different Bible studies.
Oh, oh my gosh, my goodness. More than I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, but one of them was like 30 men. I mean, yeah, either well, not. Yeah.
But still, so I've talked about this a lot. I've thought about it a lot. When we're talking about this falling away, what I think it's actually pointing to is when Jesus teaches about the church, one of the parables he uses is this idea that when seeds are planted, the early plants all look the same. The weeds and the wheat in the field look the same. And it's not until the harvest that they'll be differentiated and that it's all going to be kind of sorted out by him at the end. And I think that's part of what this is referring to, that like right now there are people in church that aren't really in it for Jesus. They're not really choosing him. And we don't know who that is. We can't really discern everybody's motives. But at the end, right before he comes back, it'll be pretty clearly divided. People are going to fall away in the sense that those that are pretending or aren't really getting it or whatever are going to go to something else. And those that are faithful to Jesus will still be here. And that'll be them falling off.
Yeah, I think they're in it for the 45-minute message instead of brunch on Sundays, which is something I would question. But I agree. You know, I think it goes back to... it's going to reveal what you really love in the end, whether it's yourself or Jesus. And so the people that don't really love Jesus, well, when it gets hard, love Jesus. And so they'll fall off. And there'll be a lot of people that do. And so it's just something to watch out for. I don't think we get overly descriptive when we talk about these things and we try to read these moments into all the moments. And that's a problem in how we interpret the text. So every earthquake's not the end time. And every time somebody doubts their faith, isn't this apostasy? So I just be really careful with how we apply these principles that are set to happen one time in the future when Jesus is righting all wrongs or starting to, to a degree that's higher than how we live now. So I think they're all things to watch out for and to know, but I'd be careful in applying it. If you apply it like every day, we're probably misapplying this text a little bit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the last question we'll end with is literally about like the last things, but pre-millennialism, post-millennialism, or all millennialism. What does CBC believe, and how should we think about this question? Should we define terms?
Let's define terms.
So pre, and post-millennial?
Well, so all of them are related to this word millennium,
yep.
Right? So what's the millennium?
Christ's thousand-year kingdom, man.
And that comes from Revelation chapter 20.
That's right.
Where it talks about Jesus returning, and then he reigns for 1,000 years, and certain things are happening. There's resurrections that are happening. Satan is being bound up. And there's been lots of opinions about what to do with this passage. But they fall into these three big buckets of, if that millennium is going on, what is the relationship between that 1,000 years and the return of Jesus? So pre-millennial people are going to say that Jesus is going to return, and then that 1,000 years that's talked about in chapter 20 follows Jesus' return. Other people are going to say that 1,000 years is going on, and that Jesus returns at the end of that. And then other people are going to say that 1,000 years is not a literal number. It's referring to just a long amount of time from when Jesus ascended to when he returns.
Mm-hmm.
And so those would be the amillennial people. The people that say he's coming after are the post-millennial people. The people he's saying coming before are the pre-millennial people. And it has to do with, you know, sort of the timeline of how you see things shaken out in the book of Revelation. But what I like about all of those is that all those positions are excited about Jesus coming back.
It's important. Yeah. It's like Jesus coming back. Jesus, also the culmination of his kingdom where he rules and reigns. Only he rules and reigns. Yeah. We're all looking forward to the future when that happens.
Yeah.
So I'd say, you know, our doctrinal statement leans more premillennial than anything else. Because that's kind of the typical language that you know, evangelicalism has fallen in love with over the last, you know, 50 years. And I think there's a lot of validity and truth to that. But at the same time, I'm okay if you believe any one of those. I think you are clearly a Christ follower if you believe any one of those. Then you can come to Crossroads if you believe any one of those. It goes back to, you know, we're going to major in the major and minor in the minors. That is a minor one because it is a timeline that we don't know about God fulfilling the promises that we do know. So as long as we can get excited about the promises, I'm good with it.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, if you look at something like the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed,
yeah.
Like what are the majors having to do with eschatology, end time stuff? The majors is that Jesus is coming back and then he's going to raise everybody when he comes back.
Yep.
That's what he said. On the last day, he'll raise up those that he's called to himself. So like those are the majors. He's returning and he's going to raise the dead. Everything else is something where I think we can generously believe or not believe and have disagreements and yet love one another.
Yeah, I think it's good. So we answered all the questions about the beginnings and the ends. There's no more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for joining Britt's podcast today and Revelation, everybody. But I love that you've come here and taught that stuff. It's been a while since I've studied it, and it's not my favorite stuff to teach. I like more the practical side of things, but it's really important to know that in the end, God wins, and then parse out how we think that's going to happen as long as we hold it pretty openly. Mm-hmm. And like we say, at the beginning of these and at the end of these, this series that we did is simply for us to grow in our understanding and knowledge of God's faithfulness and goodness. And so discussions help us do that. So this is a place where we can disagree with wisdom and with love. And so if you agree with us, cool. If you disagree, that's great too. We disagree with each other sometimes. But I hope this conversation has helped you see more of God's goodness. It's helped you invite more discussion into your life, because it's only when that happens that we grow our faith about this God that should be known, can be known, and will ultimately be known one day when we are with him forever. Talking about Revelation. Good? Thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time. See ya.